From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. Leaders of the world's biggest economies are meeting at Camp David this weekend, and there will be some new faces around the table. Since the last G8 summit, France, Japan, and Italy have elected new leaders. French President François Hollande was sworn in just 3 days ago, and this morning he stopped by the White House for a pre-summit meeting with President Obama. Here's NPR's Scott Horsley.
It's a stressful time for the new French president as the Greek debt crisis sends tremors throughout the wider eurozone. That's the topic that's expected to dominate the G8 this weekend. President Obama says it was his main focus in meeting with President Hollande.
President Hollande and I agree that this is an issue of extraordinary importance not only to the people of Europe but also to the world economy.
As European governments wrestle with their economic problems, the United States is largely a spectator, albeit a very interested one. After their conversation at the White House, Hollande said he and Mr. Obama share similar views about what needs to happen in Europe.
La croissance doit être une priorité en même temps.
Growth must be a priority, Hollande said, even as European governments work to reduce their budget deficits. Jobs and economic growth must be encouraged. Mr. Obama has been making much the same argument here at home. While Republicans focus on reducing government budget deficits, the president has argued for more government investment in things like public works projects to address persistently high unemployment. In Europe, the advocates for austerity have held sway in recent years, led by German Chancellor Angela Merkel, but the pendulum may be swinging back now. Heather Conley, a European expert at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, says with the election of the left-leaning Hollande in France, Mr. Obama may have found a kindred spirit.
There is great convergence between Washington and Paris about creating that balance.
The two men don't have much time to get to know one another before their partnership is put to the test. Mr. Obama's been boning up on the new French president's biography. He says he was interested to learn that as a young man, Hollande spent time in the U.S. studying American fast food.
Although he decided to go into politics, we'll be interested in his opinions of cheeseburgers in Chicago.
And cementing the transatlantic alliance, Mr. Obama noted, nothing goes better with cheeseburgers than French fries. Scott Horsley, NPR News, the White House.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Facebook, the social media titan, got a lot more social today. It is now a publicly traded company. After a delay and some glitches, the company's shares began trading on NASDAQ. They didn't pop, but they didn't swoon either. At the end of the day, Facebook stock finished just a tad above its opening price of $38 a share. As NPR's Steve Henn reports, the message at Facebook's Menlo Park headquarters was simple: stay focused.
Facebook's motto internally in the early days was move fast and break things. It took on internet giants by being nimble. Its culture was flat. 5 years ago, a brand new engineer sent out an email to everyone at the company and organized an all-night coding marathon, a hackathon, in just minutes. These hackathons are Red Bull-fueled brainstorming sessions, and some of Facebook's most successful products, such as the Like button, have grown out of them. Last night, Facebook held its 31st hackathon. The message? Nothing here is going to change. We'll still move fast. We will still break things. When it was all over, a cheering crowd gathered in the middle of Facebook's campus.
All right, everyone, are you ready?
Then Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook's 28-year-old CEO, rang the opening bell on the NASDAQ stock exchange, and Facebook began its life as a public company. It was a party. Sheryl Sandberg, Facebook's COO, was bouncing on her toes. And then, pretty quickly, it was over. David Z says employees milled around, snapped some photos, and in about 20 minutes headed back to work. Z is one of Facebook's early backers. Greylock, the venture capital firm where he's a partner, invested $12 million in the company back in 2006. Today, that investment is worth 200 times what he paid.
I think that's about right.
Their stake is worth hundreds of millions.
I actually think it's more than that. It's over $1 billion.
Z's firm sold a couple hundred million dollars of Facebook stock this morning. But most little mom-and-pop investors didn't get a crack at buying any from him. Like in most IPOs, the vast majority of stock that's sold by insiders or the company itself went to institutional investors or wealthy individuals. Little retail investors had to wait until the stock began trading publicly.
I had a phone call from one of our online brokers this morning.
Steve Kay is managing director of the Knight Group.
They were flooded with hundreds and hundreds of orders. It was almost like people were sitting by their desktop waiting for them to be open to trade so they could put in their buy orders.
His company executes these kinds of small stock orders on behalf of brokerages. He says he's never seen demand quite like this in the first few hours from small investors.
I think it's safe to say it's been unprecedented.
Some would-be buyers got pretty aggressive with their offers.
We had somebody wanted to buy as high as $4,000.
A share. Because of crazy bids like that, it took almost 2 hours for trading to start. Then there were glitches. At one point, Facebook's shares were actually trading down. By mid-afternoon, the mania many had anticipated had faded. Facebook's shares were basically flat, and David Z was already looking for the next big thing.
Well, I think the question I would always ask is, where's the next Facebook?
And you didn't have to travel far from Facebook's headquarters to find a tech giant in trouble. A couple miles away at Hewlett-Packard, employees there were rattled by a report that firm could announce 30,000 layoffs next week. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Let's return to our series, Family Matters, examining the way that different generations of families are increasingly moving in together under the same roof to get by. Today, we return to a family that had to make a difficult decision to ensure that an elderly parent keeps getting the care she needs. We'll have more on that in a moment. First, David Green is here. David, would you remind us about this family?
Yeah, Steve, we're returning to the Hunter Christian family from Maryland. We had them on air a few weeks ago. You might remember the matriarch is a woman named Ida Christian. She's 89 years old, suffering from Alzheimer's.
Sing your favorite song.
What is my favorite song?
Okay, I'm going to say the first couple words. It's your thing. Do what you want to do.
It's your thing, do what you want to do.
David, who's the younger voice we're hearing there?
That is Ida's granddaughter, Yolanda, who cares for her during the day. As you might remember, this family really determined not to place Ida Christian in a nursing home. And so Yolanda actually quit her job as a human resources director to begin taking care of her grandma full time.
She quit her job, and as I recall, we talked with an expert about that sacrifice not too long ago, the fact that many caregivers, family caregivers, end up giving up a job.
That's exactly right, and that's where we left Yolanda's story a few weeks back. So she's 43 years old. She's been out of work now for 2 years taking care of her grandma, and since our last story, she's really been working hard to try and get her career going again. She started doing some part-time work for a headhunting company. And I caught up with her on this really chaotic day. She had all of these meetings scheduled, but the nurse who was supposed to come in and watch her grandmother for her canceled at the last minute.
Totally frustrating because I got to reschedule these people. So I got to reschedule the nurse to come back in. Hopefully she'll be available to come so I can get these interviews done and get these applicants out to these clients. And if the clients like them, they can get hired and then I can make some extra money. And for me, it's like, geez, I can't keep doing this. It's crazy for me and it's just too much.
Okay, so taking care of Ida while also trying to work at least a little bit is too much for Yolanda. So what are the options for the family now?
I think the family's come to one of these defining moments that a lot of multi-generational families face when just something has to give. There needs to be another sacrifice. And so to get Yolanda back to work as she wants to do, they really need another daytime caregiver. To pay for that, they need to free up some money somehow. And one option that they came up with was to sell a house that Ida used to live in, and that takes us to Richmond, Virginia.
Can you show us around the house a little bit? Is it?
Yeah, it's possible.
Is that okay?
Come on, yeah.
Great, thank you.
So the person we're hearing from right there is Frank Christian, and he is Ida's son. And really, Steve, this is a reminder of how one challenge in a multi-generational family can involve so many people in the family. Frank lives in the house in Richmond that we're talking about. He built it with his mom, Ida. They lived together for years. I mean, it's really this beautiful six-bedroom colonial in a leafy neighborhood. There's a basketball court in the backyard where Frank and his mom spent a lot of time.
My mother used to come down here sometimes and shoot the ball with me, too.
No, she did.
Yes, she did.
Really?
Yeah. When we first moved, because I was always out here shooting. Like I said, you know, we're like buddies, so she would come, oh, yeah, I can shoot better than you, so she'd come out and throw up a few.
She show you up?
No. No. I'm competitive, man. You ain't gonna beat me.
So with time, Ida's Alzheimer's got worse, and there were fewer moments like that out on the basketball court.
Those last couple of years, I mean, she really wasn't connected because she was losing memory, and talking about the past, not talking about here, and just not connected. So, but I guess with that process, you know, that kind of, you know, put this in perspective for me.
And one thing that Frank realized, his mom needed help bathing, getting dressed, and Frank felt he couldn't really do these things for her. And so Ida moved to Maryland to live with Yolanda's family. One thing Frank could do was sell this house in Richmond. It took 2 years because of a really tough housing market, and it took time for Frank to let go. But he finally sold the property just a few weeks ago for close to $400,000. So now Frank is moving with his own family to a much smaller two-bedroom rental. But he says this feels right. He feels like he's doing his part for his mom and also for his niece, Yolanda, so she can finally get her career back. And Steve, there's also something special about who bought this house.
And I think she's a single mom, but she suddenly was looking for a house, and particularly one like this, because she suddenly had to change her lifestyle because she has to take care of her parents. Now, I don't know what the circumstances are, but I thought that was kind of neat.
Wow.
That, you know, we built this for that reason, and now the people moving in it are using it for that reason. So that's kind of cool.
So they've raised the money for an extra caregiver, David Green, by selling this house, but that's got to be tough to sell a house that's been in the family like that.
It was tough, and you know, there were some tensions. That, you know, Frank had to be convinced, and the family kind of struggled with both the whether to sell the house and when was the right time.
And I think a lot of families have had that same struggle, David Green. So let's get into it a little bit more deeply here. Selling a house can raise some money. It can also bring up emotional struggles. And to talk about that, we called up Linda Fodrini-Johnson. She is a geriatric care manager, runs a firm that does that, and is also the past president of the National Association of Professional Geriatric Care Managers. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about this situation that we've just heard about, which has got to be very common for many people across the country. Mom needs care. Yolanda needs to get back to work and can't care for her all the time anymore, so they decide to sell the house. What do you think of that choice?
Well, sometimes it is the only choice families have, but other times families really need to look into federal and state benefits that might have helped with the cost of care in the home if they were entitled to it. And the other issue is the house is a place. A home is a history. It's a history of a family. It's an emotional attachment, and it's really a hard decision for families to make. But they have to make it in some circumstances, like in this family's circumstance.
I'm curious, as someone who advises people in this situation, would you put so much emotional weight on the value of keeping the home that you might sometimes advise people that you could hang on to that, even if it's not the absolute strictly best financial decision?
Yeah, I can. And I actually have a checklist that I developed. Do I have a safety net in this home? You can't stay in it if you have three stories and you have a movement disorder or you have Parkinson's, something that's going to advance unless you remodel it. What does the home mean to you? Is it more important for you to be close to those that you're most intimate with, your children, your grandchildren? Every decision with every family is going to be slightly different.
Now, I understand that you're dealing with this issue yourself.
I am. I have a 90-year-old mom. I have three brothers. My mother is currently in assisted living. She still owns her home in San Francisco. One of her grandchildren, my nephew, lives in it. But I have legal authority, but I meet with my brothers and talk about what we should do with the home. And because there's an emotional attachment to it, that home means my father to my mother, who died 30 years ago, but it's so important to her. I've decided that the best move for us is to keep the home, but to rent it.
The fact that you're making these decisions about your mom's house with your three brothers seems to raise all kinds of potential for emotional conflict.
You know, it does raise some potential, but I guess I'm a licensed therapist. I know how to run a family meeting. I'm keeping them in the loop of the decisions I'm making and the choices I have.
You must have run into plenty of families that have all but split up over this.
Many families that don't talk to each other after a parent dies and a house is sold. I can't tell you how many.
Linda Fodrini-Johnson is former president of the National Association of Professional Geriatric Care Managers and is a geriatric care manager herself in San Francisco. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Remember, you can follow this series online. You can see photos of Ida Christian's family and hear other stories in the series at NPR.org.
One of the perks of living in Europe is the generous amount of vacation time, or was a perk. Nowadays, governments looking to cut costs are cutting public holidays. Portugal recently cut 4 of its 14 annual days off, and Spain is playing with its calendar to shorten long holiday weekends, time off that the prime minister says Spain can no longer afford. From Madrid, Lauren Freyer reports on the loss of a much-loved tradition.
The Paso Doble anthem blasts from the iron gates of Madrid's ornate bullring. It's a random Tuesday in May, and Madrileños are off work yet again. It's a local holiday for the start of the spring bullfighting season. Sangria flows at bars in the bullring's shadow. People actually haven't worked since Friday. It's what Spaniards call a puente, or bridge, weekend. When a holiday falls on a Tuesday, people skip work on Monday, the bridge day, to make an extra long weekend. Some offices close altogether. Even people hit hard by the recession here, like Clara de Jorge, 23 and unemployed, find a way to celebrate.
I didn't have money to go away, but I still try to enjoy it. Just staying in a park, going to a museum, everything's for free. So that's what I did, because I can't afford going on a trip.
But these long weekends are about to get shorter. Later this year, the government plans to move any holidays that fall on a Tuesday or Thursday to Monday, similar to the way Americans celebrate Memorial or Labor Day. 4-day weekends will become 3-day ones. De Jorge says that's not enough time to visit her family in Valencia.
What we do on the puentes is we have a chance to get the car, get your family, and go away for a few days. But we just have like 3 days where not going to have that chance to go to the country or go to the beach or whatever.
But the government says it's a necessary change to boost productivity and bring work schedules more in line with the rest of the world.
I can remember working in the banking sector and the problems we had being on the same schedule with other financial centers.
Former banker Gail Allard is now an economist at Madrid's IE Business School.
People were working their traditional day with a long lunch. If they could kind of align working hours, drop the idea of the siesta, it actually might even be beneficial to Spaniards to work a sort of more compact day and week.
But aside from regular Spaniards who relish their time off, there's also opposition from the Catholic Church, which bristles at the idea that the day of the Blessed Virgin's Immaculate Conception, for example, might be moved. Christmas and Easter would stay put, however. Talks are underway to get the regions to agree as well. Different provinces here have their own holidays. Any given week, at least one Spanish city is on vacation. And that's frustrating to outsiders, such as EU leaders in Northern Europe, whom Spain is trying to court, says economist Fernando Fernandez.
This is a kind of symbolic change, which gives an indication of the degree of reform commitment of the government, in a way. And it's one of those things that the markets love. They love to see that the governments are determined to take unpopular decisions for the good of the nation.
It's also likely to save the government some money, and that couldn't come at a better time, says Javier Diaz Jimenez at IESE Business School.
Every penny counts. Say it buys you €500 million worth of GDP. I mean, then you don't need to scrape it from education or healthcare or other expenditures, so that's very nice.
Back near the bullring, Clara de Jorge says she's not convinced.
We have these traditions and we can't change that. People is very used to that. I don't think that works.
But de Jorge, like roughly half of 20-somethings here, is jobless. Shorter weekends come with wide-ranging labor reforms that the government is hoping might, just might, get her back to work. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Freyer in Madrid.